All right. Looking again at Luke chapter 11, what Jesus has to say about prayer, it's vital. We've walked through the parable to the end. It's vital that we understand, I hope you all understand this, that Jesus is creating a hypothetical scenario that is not true, not adequate, not correct. What he's doing is saying, imagine your fears. Bring your misconceptions about God to the surface. Here's your misconception. Here's your fear. That he's irritable, doesn't answer ordinary, common requests, that he's mean-spirited, that he's indifferent, and so on when it comes to our answering our needs. One way you can tell this is the way he starts it. Now, in the NIV, the parable starts with the little comment, suppose one of you has a friend. You see that in your NIV if you have an NIV. But there are... the literal Greek does not begin with the word suppose. It begins with a question. Who of you has a friend? And Jesus uses that little formula, who of you has this or who of you would do that, a number of times in the Gospels, and each time he uses it to introduce something that's impossible or foolish, like, for example, in Luke 12:25, who of you by worrying can add a single hour to your life? Can anybody do that? Can you do that? No. Who of you would leave an ox in a ditch on a Sabbath day? Would you do that? Would you let an animal die when it fell down a ditch because it was a Sabbath? No. Who of you, 17:7, would invite a dirty, smelly laborer who just came in from the field to sit down with you at your table for dinner if you were the master of house? Would anybody do that? No. You tell them to clean up first if you invited him at all. So Jesus uses the question, who of you, to introduce impossible things that he wants to think about. He often does it with a parable. And this is one of those impossible things. Namely, it's not possible that God would really be like this. But he says, let's bring it out in the open. Let's imagine that God is, in fact, disinterested in us. Even if he were, he would, for his own name's sake, to avoid being put to shame, for his own name's sake, he would answer our prayer. Now, after he has answered our fear, he then tells us what is actually true, and that's what comes in verses 9 through 13. 9 through 13 reads, so I say to you, ask and it will be given. See, it will be given by God. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened. For everyone who asks receives. He who seeks does find. And to the one who knocks, the door will be opened. And God is really like a father to us. Verse 11. Which of you fathers, if your son asks for a fish, will give him a snake instead? Or if he asks for an egg, will give him a scorpion? If you then, though you are evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father in heaven? You see, he is your Father. He's not a poor neighbor. He is your Father. How much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts, the best gift, the Holy Spirit, to those who ask? So, after labeling our fear, he then tells us what the truth is. And notice, if you would, a little technique that Jesus uses. We'll see it again in the course. I'm going to give you a word you haven't heard. Inclusio. Or, if you like, there's an English word that's a little bit like it. Inclusion. And that's when a key word or key phrase appears at the beginning and the end of a passage to frame the passage, like the two ends of a book cover. Now notice, at the beginning, Jesus says, when you pray, say, Father. That's the first thing he says. And at the end of the passage, he says, your Father will give good gifts. So first and last, he says, God is a Father. The one to whom we pray is a Father. In the middle, he says, I know what some of you think sometimes, and I would like to address that. Let me stop right there. I know that what I'm just saying now is in some ways agreeable to all of you, and yet I know that some of you have heard this particular parable explained differently. Does anybody have a question they'd like to raise? Yes. Right. I'm saying two things. The question is, what about the boldness? I'm saying two things. First of all, the word boldness is, everybody knows this. Every scholar knows this. The word boldness is not really a literal translation of the Greek word there. The Greek word there, if any of you know Greek, is anaideon. And the word anaideon always means, always has to do with shame, and specifically, shamelessness. A desire to avoid shame. And then I'm saying, second, that the desire to avoid shame does not belong to the person who's knocking. First of all, it doesn't even say knocks. It says later in verse 9 to 13, but in the parable, the word knock never appears. Certainly, he might have called to him. He might have whispered through his window. They had open windows. They didn't have glass, We're talking about the shame belonging to the asker, the petitioner, not the sleeper. And I tried to walk through the structure of the passage to show you that all the assertions about giving and so forth are about the sleeper. When you have a change of antecedent, see, the whole verse is about the asker, asker, asker. If you have a change of reference for a pronoun, his boldness, you've got to make it clear that the change has taken place. And the text does not indicate that there's a change of the subject. So if there's no change of the subject, you have to assume that the subject is the same, namely the asker. Yes, very good. Somebody else asked that during break. It is actually true that it would be a disgrace. The question is, does the shame belong to the person who's asking because they might be put to shame for not having a meal for that friend? It's true that they would experience some shame if they didn't provide for their friend. That is a true statement. However, the shame would be mitigated by the fact that he came at midnight, because travelers did not ordinarily come at midnight. It is true, if you know the ancient Near East really well, somebody might say this, it is true that in some places travel took place at night because it was so hot. But Israel is not that hot. We talked about that in our very first day together. Israel is warm, but it's actually not hot. The summer in Israel, in most of Israel where it's populated, is cooler than it is in most cities in North America, for example. Maybe not Minnesota or Bangor, Maine, but most cities would be in America warmer. So a midnight traveler would be very rare. It would be a surprise, and the shame would actually fall to the whole village more than that man, because he didn't know. There was no way you could expect it. Yes. That's right. That's right. The man would not be put to shame because he tried. That's exactly correct. Yeah. Right. Why would the sleeper be ashamed? Both of your statements would be true. He would be ashamed because he would know he should do better. He'd be ashamed specifically. The golden rule is true, but the thing is, in that culture, you just had to give somebody food when they've been trapped. There was not another place. If you didn't give them food, they would go hungry. And everybody knew that. The analogy today would be something like this. If you were driving down a back road in Kansas or Nebraska or New Mexico or North Dakota or Maine or one of these very thinly, or Alaska, and it was dark and it was getting very cold and snow was starting to fall, and one of these roads, if some of you know them, one of these roads where a car passes every 2 hours and you did not stop, that would be an unspeakable shame to do that. And in fact, you might even be able to be sued and taken to court if people knew. It would be terrible to fail to stop. The social pressure, a situation like that in the back roads in America, is enormous to stop. You must stop if somebody's broken down at night when it's cold. You have to. And it would be very similar. Everybody knows you should take care of it. Yes? Is there some comparison to the parable of talents? I think the idea is you must, I agree with you on this point, you must use what you have. You must use what you have. If you have food, you must use it. You must share it. That's right. Good questions. I knew you'd have questions. Glad to entertain your questions. One more. Very good. Very good. The point, in case you didn't hear it, is there's nothing in the Bible that makes us think that if we pound or hound and sort of force God's hand, He will give us what we ask for. First of all, as you pointed out, Sermon on the Mount says, don't babble with vain repetition. Now, let me say quickly, I'm all in favor of consistent or persistent prayer. I'm just saying, that's not, number one, this parable is not about persistent prayer. There's other places in the Bible where it teaches be persistent, but this isn't it. One. Two, persistence alone is not going to make God change His mind. If God is not giving you, if I can just take that point a little bit farther, something I really want to say. If God is not giving you something, it's not because He's disinterested. It's because He has something better in view. And if He refuses to give you the job that you want, it's because He has a better job for you. That's the idea. Let me tell you a story that kind of brought this home for me in, I hope, an interesting way. In India, there are a lot of beggars. And when I was there, I guess about not quite a year ago by now, I saw them. They'd be on bridges, they'd be on roads, whenever there were a good chance of having people who would be tourists or have some money. They'd be there asking for money. It seems to be the kind and compassionate thing. After all, you give them $1, that can take care of them for days and days. And it would seem the most logical thing, especially when you are looking at a child who's crippled or if you're looking at a leper. And yet my hosts, missionaries who spent most of their life in India, said, you must not give to the beggars. Now my host is a loving Christian man. He said, you must not give. You must not accede to their request. You want to know why? Because leprosy is a 100% easily curable disease. If somebody in India today has leprosy, there are two possibilities. One, they're so backward they don't know and they're ashamed of being discovered and they don't want to take the medication. The main reason is that they want it. You know why you would want leprosy? In order to be a better beggar. So if you give to them, you are encouraging them to live a life of deformity. It is a deforming disease. One. Two, if you give to a child that is deformed, has broken bones or so forth, you must understand that this child is owned by the Indian, I'll call it the mafia. It's not really a mafia. This is an owned child. They steal children, break their bones, and do not set them so they're deliberately deformed. And then they take 90% of all the money they get begging. So if you give money to those kids, you are contributing to the deliberate deformity of other children. So don't give. Now that's an extreme example, but I'm saying it's just a small illustration of the fact that what seems to be a logical, good request may be a deadly request. And God knows. If He says no, He may know things about the situation that we don't know. In fact, I suppose it's fair to say He always knows things about every situation that we don't know, just to get it back to the realm of theology a little bit. Okay, now, just to finish it off, let me get clear of the theology of prayer. This is our big main focus. Does Luke teach persistence in prayer? Most definitely he does. Is it right to spend some time attending to the method of prayer, the words of prayer? Is it even good to get up early in the morning and pray? Those are fine. Certainly we should get the words right. Certainly, however, the root of prayer is to understand that God is good, God is loving, and He does want to give us what is good. And it's not our manipulation, but it's His goodness that makes Him give to us. Let me look at a second theme from the Gospel of Luke that also shows up on in a parable. It's a second theme, like prayer, that is pervasive in Luke and especially pervasive in this great travel narrative, as it is called, from the time when Jesus sets out for Jerusalem. And that is the theme of money. It appears in Luke chapter 12, especially. Theme of money. Money is, of all the topics Jesus addressed, the most common. He addressed money more than he addressed parenting, or good marriage, or how to get along with your neighbors, or what a good work ethic is. Number one topic is money. And it comes up in Luke 12, it comes up in Luke 16, it comes up in Luke several other times briefly, twice pretty long in Luke, and several other times rather briefly in Luke 9 through 19. I want to propose to you just briefly that this is something that not only Luke knew his readers needed, but it's something we all need. Let me just tell you one simple illustration. A few years ago, I was talking about money to one of my classes, and one of my students said, "You might want to look at this." It was a poll that was in USA Today. And the poll was the question people love to ask, "What would you do for $1 million?" The questions were just a little different, though. Would you do one of the four following things for $1 million? Would you spend 2 years in jail? Would you permanently move to a foreign country? Let me just tell you quickly. 42% of the people said they would do at least one or maybe more of these things for $1 million. Would you spend 2 years in jail? Would you permanently move to a foreign country? Would you never see your best friend again? Or would you throw your pet off a cliff? I had a parakeet. It's true. I had a parakeet at the time. So I said, "I'm caught." You know, Americans love to play the game, "What would you do for $1 million, right? Love to ask that question. We love to toy with the question, you know, what would we do if we were rich? Now, of course, the question is a game. The question is a game sometimes, and of course other times it's absolutely serious. And it's absolutely serious in Luke chapter 12. Jesus in Luke 12 is teaching a large crowd about the nature of discipleship. And as he teaches them, he's running through some of the themes that we know are significant. And, for example, he warns his disciples against hypocrisy and the corrosive effects. He urges them to not fear those who can kill the body, but not any more than that, can't destroy the soul. He urges them to confess or acknowledge him before men. He tells them that if they're brought before rulers and called to account, the Holy Spirit will teach them what to say. And Jesus is running through these teachings in Luke 12, 1 to 12, on discipleship. And then I can almost imagine he did what you see me do from time to time, and that is pause and take a sip of water. And while he pauses, someone in the crowd takes advantage of that moment of silence. And in verse 13, someone in the crowd said to him, someone in the crowd, if you've got a red letter Bible, it's a wall of red. And you get this one little blurt of black. Somebody says, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, we don't know the details of this man's life or of his concerns. But there was a custom that in Israel, if a man has two sons, the older gets two-thirds, the younger gets one-third. But now if you have three children, then it's half and one-sixth and one-third. And if you have half-brothers and half-sisters, and if there's controversy, things could go wrong. And so he feels that somehow or other the division of property has gone wrong. Jesus answers him this way. He says, "Man, who appointed me a judge or arbiter between you?" Now, what he's doing here actually is regarding Jesus as a teacher or a rabbi. Teachers or rabbis were considered to be arbiters, to be decision makers that a righteous person might seek out. Jesus says, "What makes you think that I'm going to resolve in your favor here?" But then he went on to say, "I may not give you what you want, but I'll give you something else." He said, "Watch out, be on guard against all kinds of greed, because a man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions." Now, I've given you one technique tonight called inclusio. I'm going to give you a second one, repetition. Jesus says, "Watch out, be on guard." He says it twice. He says it twice in a row. When he says, watch out, be on guard twice in a row, it's probably because we need to watch out. It is very easy, specifically, to think that life does consist in the abundance of one's possessions. Can I ask you to just play a little mental game with me for a minute? Imagine that you are a college freshman again, and for the sake of imagination, let's imagine that you're all males, and your name is Leonard. And poor Leonard is a college freshman. It is now March, and he has not had a single date all year. And he thinks he knows why. Now, the reason is that he doesn't have a car. And so he prays, Lord, I have no social life whatsoever. If you would give me a car, then I would have a girl. And so he prays for a car, and the Lord gives him a 1968 Volkswagen. Now, Volkswagens are kind of cool and kind of not cool. The cool part is, you know how old and retro they are. But the not cool part is that they break down constantly. And so word gets out pretty fast. If you go out on a date with Leonard, there's a 42% chance of walking back. And so Leonard still has no social life at all. And so Leonard prays. He says, Lord, thank you. Give me a car. But what I really need is a reliable car. So Leonard prays. And the Lord gives Leonard a reliable car. Aunt Gertrude has decided she can no longer drive. And she has a 1971 Rambler Ambassador. She had a few kind of wild nephews and nieces, and they used to spray Cheese Whiz down the vents. And she's got a little exhaust gas recirculation, partially burnt motor oil, kind of recirculates a little bit. And between the smell of the cheese and the partially burned oil, Leonard still has no social life at all. So Leonard prays. He says, Lord, what I really need is something kind of exciting, something that will really get a girl's attention. And so Leonard gets a 1992 Firebird, 492 horsepower, 3.6 miles per gallon, $4,822 every 6 months for insurance. Leonard has a car, but he still has no social life because the girl would have to take him out. And so Leonard prays again, Lord, what I really need, and of course, what has Leonard done? He's decided that he would have an abundant life if he just had the right possession. Now, of course, we're not just talking about Leonard here, are we? We're talking about Leonard. Maybe I just told you a parable. We're talking about Leonard. We're talking about all of us. We're talking about the way we can think, if I just had the right thing, maybe it's a house with one more room, just one more room, just enough money to take a real vacation and not have to go to my mother's house or my wife's house every year. I mean, how exciting is downtown Detroit anyway? Or it could be clothes. It could be a car. Maybe you're, you know, ashamed of the car you drive. It's, you know, gets you from here to there, but it's kind of ugly and beat up. If I just had a car, people would treat, you know. We think that way. Watch out. Be on guard. Life does not consist in the abundance of your possessions. So Jesus tells us a story about it. Now, the story seems counterintuitive initially, because the man in the parable says his problem is that he doesn't have enough money. Sorry, the man in the crowd says he doesn't have enough money, and the man in the parable has too much money. Outwardly, they're opposites, but inwardly, they are the same, because they both share the conviction that the right possessions is the key to the abundant life. Let's go through the parable. Maybe I'll just read a little bit of it to you first. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. And he said, this is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and I'll build bigger ones, and there I'll store my grain and my goods. So far. He sees that he has a problem. Storage. He has to protect his non-durable assets. The Lord's given him an abundant crop, and he needs to take care of that crop. His solution is bigger barns. Capital investment designed to protect those assets. Seems very logical. His satisfaction, he says, once I finish this, I'm going to take my life easy. However, We can also see that there is some folly about this man. And while I read through it rather rapidly, if we read through it a little bit slower, a little bit differently, you see that this man is not simply a wise businessman. In fact, he is an egotist. And I'm going to show it to you by emphasizing the pronouns. Here we go. What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns, and I will build bigger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods, and I will say to myself, in the Greek it actually says next, self. I will say to myself, self. You have plenty of good things laid up for many years. You take life easy. You eat. You drink. You be merry. In the Greek, there are 51 words. Depending on how you count things, 16 or 17 of them have I, me, my, myself, or a command he gives to himself, you eat, you drink. He is a total egotist. His surprise is that he finds, now here's, I've given you two, here's a third methodological hint tonight. There are, it seems that there is one monologue in all of Jesus' parables. It seems that there is exactly one parable in which somebody talks to himself, and this is it. But what we find is that there are no monologues. Because although he thought he was talking to himself, there is someone else in the room. And that someone else is God. And he has been listening. And he says to him, you fool, this very night your life is required of you, demanded of you. The Greek word could be used, recalled. Your life and all that you possess is a loan, and it's going to be recalled. And now you are going to be disappointed because the things you prepared, whose will they be? Answer, not yours. Not yours. His sorrow is that his God, Mammon, disappointed him in the hour of greatest need, which is what Mammon always does and what gods always do. They always disappoint us when we need them the most. And the lesson is this, be rich toward God. And that could be a fair theme statement for the whole Gospel of Luke on how to use money. Be rich toward God. Now, he actually does it two ways. He says, first of all, you need to be rich toward God by using your mind. And if you follow what comes next, he gives six reasons not to worry. That's the first way to be rich. Again, it's not a matter of technique, but he gives reasons. The reasons are, verse 23, there is more to life than food and clothing. Reason number two, the ravens do not toil, they don't fret, they don't store up, yet God cares for them and we're worth more than the ravens. The third reason is that worrying can't do anything. You can't add anything to your life by worrying. The fourth reason is that God clothes even wild flowers and grasses with beauty, even though their blooms last but a day. And certainly you are more valuable than they. Reason five is, you're not pagans. The pagans run and strive after all these things. But that's not who you are. The sixth reason is, your Heavenly Father knows what you need. Therefore, be rich toward God first with your mind by not worrying. And then second, positively be rich toward God by, verse 31, seeking first the kingdom. And second, verse 33, by giving away your treasures. And third, verse 34, by storing up treasure in heaven, by being content with what you have. Now, I suppose that there are some people in this room, if I can speak to you directly, there are some people in this room who would say, well, you know, this is a parable. A lot of people needed that in the old days when there wasn't enough food, when there was enough money. You know, we don't really need that today. Maybe somebody might say that. I want to be careful to make just this point. Every group is liable to greed. The richest person can imagine a scenario in which they will somehow run out of money, and therefore they need more. And the poorest person, easily persuades themselves that they need more. And Christians who know they're supposed to be content can fall into greed and into misconceptions about money by perverting a few Christian ideas. For example, God loves me and is a father to me, and He wants me to be happy. And one thing that would make me happy would be if I had more possessions. So God wants me to have more possessions, so I'll pray for that and ask for that. Or here's another one. If I get rich, I will use my wealth for God. I'll be a good steward. If I get a Mercedes or a BMW, I will let the youth group drive it around from time to time. Therefore, God should give me the money to buy the Mercedes and whatever other vehicle, you know, that you want to think of. And I'll take care, if God gives me a 14-room house with 7,000 square feet, I will take care of that. And I'll use it generously for Him. Therefore, I deserve that. Now, I'm not saying, I want you to hear me carefully. I'm not saying it's evil to have wealth. It's not. It's evil to live for wealth. It's evil to set your hopes in wealth. It is possible to get wealthy by accident. By loving what you do and doing it well, you can get wealthy. It's wrong to live to get wealthy. It's not wrong to be wealthy. It is wrong to set your hopes on being wealthy. Set your heart on that as if that's the main thing. If I can just say another word to you about what this might mean for our lives, because we are talking about discipleship, I guess I'll say I feel free. Let me just give you five principles from the Bible on career choice. Career choice and the danger of charting your career path and charting your life in order to get rich. I'm saying it's all right to become wealthy if God blesses you. It's not all right to say, what shall I do? How shall I control my life so that the end point is wealth? That's the difference. Here are some principles about choosing a career. Number one, you should choose one that takes care of your basic needs. 1 Timothy chapter 6 specifies those as food and covering. We say food, clothing, and shelter. Second, your career should be one that allows you to use your gifts, even if it's not the most remunerative. Third, your career should allow you to do good for others. It should be an honest career. You don't want to be a thief, casino manager, printer of pornography, or various other things along those lines. You should be doing something constructive that actually helps people. I would say the last job I would want to have would be that of marketing fake fireplaces. Number four. Someday I'm going to say that and somebody's going to get really offended at me. I know it. Number four. It should give you an opportunity to manifest some part of God's kingdom, God's reign. Somehow, what you do should enable you to reflect His justice, His truth, His kindness, His love. Somehow you should have in your career some opportunity to move this world at least a little bit closer to the form that God would want it to have. Thy kingdom come is a prayer that is relevant for your career choice. May your kingdom come in what I do. Number five, if you get rich by accident, it's okay. But don't choose in order to get rich. Watch out. Be on guard against greed and covetousness. Let me stop right there. There's lots more things that Luke teaches about money, and you may have a question or comment you would like to make about it. Question or comment? All right. Here's a third question we have. What does it mean to be a disciple? How do you pray? What's your view of God? Number two, money. What's your view of wealth and all those sorts of things? Number three, your associations. Your associations. Now, as we work our way through the Gospel of Luke, we're just picking up Lucan themes about the nature of discipleship. And now we come to what I call, in your notes, party parables. But those party parables and teachings about parties is really about the question, with whom should I associate? Should I associate with the poor, with the outcast, and so forth? And one thing Jesus does to get this going is that he is what I call an equal opportunity party attender. So he didn't ever throw a party because he didn't have a home. But he would go to any party. If a tax collector threw a party, if a leper threw a party, one party, Simon the leper throws it. Maybe he was better by the time he offered it. I suppose he probably was, or people wouldn't have come very much. Jesus would go to parties. He would associate with all kinds of people. And one of the things that he did as a consequence of that was to go to the homes of people who were his adversaries, Pharisees and other Jewish leaders. One day, Luke chapter 14, one day Jesus was at a party, and he observed that the people there, first of all, had probably set him up by bringing a man who was crippled there on the Sabbath day to see if Jesus would heal him. They were watching him, 14:1. 14:7, he was also watching them. And when he watched them, what he noticed was that they were all picking out seats of honor. Now, then as today, you could tell your social status by where you sat at the table. And this was the arrangement they had in the ancient world. It's called a triclinium. Low tables on three sides. The most common arrangement for a banquet. The servants would enter from here. Now Jesus noticed, here's the place of honor. And then of course, you know, the closer you are to the host, the more noble your status. And then, you know, if you're down here, you're obviously a nobody and, you know, somebody couldn't come, so let's invite him. Or let's invite her. And he noticed that people were angling for the good seats. Of course, he said, you know, that could be dangerous. Because if you angle for the good seats, you may get the good seat. And then somebody else may come in late. And when they come in late, here you are at seat rank number 3. And then I'll just pick Rebecca and Carol here. So Rebecca is angling for seat number 3, but Carol's actually a closer friend. The person is throwing the party, and she has to sit way down here. And the host says, Carol, what are you doing, my buddy, my friend? What are you doing down here? We got to get you a better seat. And looks around and says, hey, you, get down there. I want Carol up here. What are you doing up here at the head table? And you will be humiliated in front of all. Now, that's what he says. Now, I don't know, why is Jesus getting into Martha Stewart territory? What exactly is going on here? Well, what he's doing, of course, is not really giving straight advice on seating arrangements. What he's really doing is saying, you know, this business about striving for honor, this is a fool's game. Honor will come to you by itself if you deserve honor. And it'll come to you when you're busy at other things, by being a friend and by doing good and so forth. One would hope, at least. It's a fool's game. He said, you know, the truth is, if you want to have a good seating arrangement, you shouldn't just worry about who sits where. You should also worry about who's there at all. Because while he noticed people striving for seats of honor and angling for the best seats, he also noticed who wasn't striving whatsoever. And those who weren't striving were, of course, those who weren't invited. That is, the poor, the crippled, the blind, the lame, the outcasts of society. And Jesus said, if you want to truly have a good feast or a good party, what you should do, verse 12, is not invite your friends and brothers and relatives and rich neighbors. You'll invite them, they'll pay you, they'll invite you, you'll scratch their back, they'll scratch yours, you'll be repaid. You want to really have a good time, you want to really be blessed, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Now, not only does Jesus say that, he then tells a parable about it, and it goes like this. After Jesus says, invite those people and you'll be repaid at the resurrection of the just, somebody in the crowd again blurts out and says, hey, you know, won't it be great? Verse 15, blessed is the man who will eat at that feast. And Jesus tells a parable which essentially says, not so fast. Are you so sure that you will be among those who are blessed to be at the feast? And here's the parable that he tells. parable is about a man who is evidently quite rich. He invites, you can tell he's rich because he's a great banquet, invites many guests, and he invites people who seem to be wealthy. In this particular parable, he invites people who say they'll come, and then, RSVP, then the time comes for the day of the feast, and they say, I'm not going to come. And they say, I'm not going to come by giving excuses. And their excuses show their social status. Excuse number one is, I have just bought a field. Please excuse me. Now, who buys a field? Well, in landowners, somebody said. That's right. And in one of the most densely populated regions of the ancient world, which Israel was, land was expensive. So probably somebody with some means. Then the second excuse is, I've just bought 5 yoke of oxen. I just bought 10 oxen. That's about like saying, I just bought 10 pickup trucks. Because that's about what oxen were like, and that's what they did. Or 5 tractors, maybe. This is a large capital investment. These are wealthy people. Second, these wealthy people who've been invited are doing something that's, again, socially outrageous. They said yes, now they're saying no. How do you like, this is the second time we've had excuses. How do you like their excuses? I've just bought a field and I have to go look at it. When do you look at it? Before you buy it. It's about like saying, I just bought a new condo and I have to go look at it. You look beforehand. Or be like saying, I just bought a brand new computer system and I have to see if it works. I have to see if it's compatible with my existing computers. Wrong. You look to see if they're compatible beforehand. These are terrible excuses. Marriage. I have married a wife. Woo. That'll keep you from going to any parties, won't it? Well, no, this is... I didn't mean it that way. What I meant was, it won't keep you. That was called sarcasm. It was called instructive irony, page 27 of Stein. It's a terrible excuse. I mean, at least my wife loves to go to parties. And she takes me with her whenever people have me. I've married a wife. That's a terrible excuse not to go to a party. Besides, you know, if you're a newlywed, you would have known that when you said yes in the first place. So, terrible excuse. So he says, well, what I need to do here is fill my banqueting hall. And so he invites other people. And he invites people from elsewhere in the town. In fact, who does he invite but those poor, crippled, blind, and lame that Jesus was talking about earlier? And they all come, and there's still room. It's a really big feast. And he says, What I want you to do next, he says to his servant, is go into the roads and lanes and compel people to come into my house. Now, what that means is, socially speaking, these are people from other villages and the countryside. If they're invited, they'll say, you can't mean it. He says, yes, I do. I mean it. But we don't even know you. We're not part of your community. We have no reason to go to your party. And he's supposed to say, I know that, but I want you to come anyway. Now, this has to do with associations, but also has something to do with something else, and that is going to become clear if we ask again the question, low-level allegory, who stands for who, what stands for what? The inviter. Who's the inviter stand for? Who would you represent? Represents God, a lot of people said, and other people said Jesus, and other people said Christ. I think it's all three. God is in the business of inviting people to himself, to his banquet. And of course, Jesus is doing the same. In fact, he does it in his ministry. He invites people to himself. Okay, who are the people who said yes and then no with miserable excuses? The Jews. All the Jews? Every last one? Which Jews? The Jewish leaders. The religious folk who said, I'll come. And then Jesus says, and says, okay, here's the party, let's go. It's time to get in the kingdom. And they said, well, gee, you know, maybe on second thought, maybe not. All right? Who are the poor, the crippled, the blind, and the lame? Think carefully. Somebody's saying it over here. Other Jews. What kind of other Jews? social outcasts, the people who initially said no or appeared to be undesirable or disinterested in God, or God seemed to be disinterested in them. The common people. And now, the fourth, those who are far out, out in the hedges, who wouldn't even know the host. This would be the Gentiles, the last people, you know, brought, you know, Romans and Greeks and Samaritans, anybody that you would think would be the last person to be invited, who would say, who, me? And yet, of course, that's what Jesus does. I mean, that's the plan also, not only of Jesus, but it's also the plan of Luke, it's the plan of God. It is consistently predicted in the Old Testament that God, although the God of the Jews, will bring the nations to Himself. And they will flood to Israel, and they'll flood to Jerusalem. And Luke consistently, from the very beginning, has said that Jesus has a mission to the entire world. He is a light of revelation to the Gentiles already when He was born. Chapter 2, verse 32. We had that. And of course, even His genealogy goes back to Adam, the father of all mankind. All throughout Luke, from the beginning to the end, and of course, certainly through the Gospel of Luke and its beginning, continuing second part in Acts, Luke is interested in saying, this is God's plan to reach the Gentiles. So we have a teaching of two sorts. One, associations, but two, a teaching. Jesus starts with something social and then He moves on to something broader, namely, He is now talking about the free offer of the gospel. That the gospel goes not just to social outcasts and people who are poor and so forth, but it goes to absolutely everyone. This is the gospel. This is the gospel. That Jesus genuinely invites you to His banquet. You are not worthy of it. You do not deserve it. You are an outcast. He says, you are invited anyway. You say, but I'm unworthy. Surely there must be something I can do. No. You're unworthy, yes. And there's nothing you can do. All you have to do is say yes. Now, we have to watch very carefully what Jesus does in the next place. The next place, after describing the free invitation to His banquet, this astonishing invitation to people who have no right to it, He then turns to the crowds and starts talking about the cost of discipleship. And what He's doing here is something we must understand if we understand the life of disciples, and that is this. There is nothing you can do in order to deserve the invitation. There is nothing you can do so that God owes you that. But once He's given it, once you're in, once you say yes, then afterwards, you owe Him everything. That's when the cost of discipleship comes up. After it's clear that you're in freely, then He can talk about giving everything back. First He gives everything. Stop. Then you give everything. Jesus says in 14:25-26, you've got to hate mother and father. You've got to carry your cross. You've got to count the cost. It's like building a tower. You don't want to start if you can't finish. Everybody will laugh at you. You don't want to go to war with a general who's more powerful than you are. Count the cost. And then He says, in case you would miss it, in the same way, any of you who does not give up everything he has cannot be my disciple. This business about bearing the cross and giving up everything you have is absolutely vital. It's also easy to miss. It's easy to miss because crosses have gotten so pretty. In Jesus' day, crosses were really ugly. They were rough. They were splintery. They were crude. Today, crosses are pretty. They're polished. They're made of silver, bronze, gold, and brass. They're light. They're so light that they can be hung from your ears and around your neck, and they float around in churches. They're real pretty. We've lost the meaning of the word cross. We've also lost the meaning, I think, many of us, what it means to give up all you have. We live in the suburbs. It's not a sin to live in the suburbs, but it blinds us a little bit. We have everything we need and a lot that we want. and the idea of really sacrificing so that we can actually hear these words is not so very close to us. Even in our churches are pretty places. Nothing wrong with being pretty. But if they get too pretty, it can undermine the message of sacrifice sometimes. I even hear the way that we talk about our choice of a church, great music ministry, great youth ministry, great blank ministry. How rarely do I hear, I joined this church because I had the opportunity to pour myself out in it. I had the chance to sacrifice in this place.